This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Max Delight shot through, grabbed the lead. Max Delight wins it.
The rail now for Zipping Rambo goes through in the Sandown Cup.
Twilight Payment, what a ride, what a win in a cup we'll never forget.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Yes, we are indeed. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Cracking the Codes. We've got a terrific show I'm really looking forward to this morning, talking about the Cox Plate Geelong Harness Cup tonight. So it goes. It's a double hitter for me, and I love those days. Simone, good morning. Matt, good morning.
Guten Morgen. How are you, Simone?
I'm good, Matt. Good morning to you. Good morning to you too, Dan. Yeah, gee, we're right in the thick of good racing all across all three codes, aren't we? It's really amping up at the moment.
I've got Cox Plate fever.
Have you?
Well, I'm sweating.
It's great to reminisce, isn't it? Those major race days, guys, and I think the history of it and our involvement in it makes it probably even more special than just looking at the field today. The history of the race sells itself to something that has captured our, well, beyond even our hearts and our minds, our whole life, to be quite truthful, and another chapter of it continues today.
Absolutely. Simone, before we are going to have a chat, I'll let the cat out of the bag. We're going to have a chat to the legendary Michael Clark later on this morning, and he's just a legend, and I'm sure that will play out during the interview to reflect on Elmerad and Better Loosen Up and Atalak and everything about the life and times of Michael Clark. But before that, quite a sombre note, of course, the death of Paul Wheeler, the legend of greyhound racing, and we're going to pay more tribute to Paul Wheeler this morning.
We are, with Paul Westerveld, who's had a very, very close association with Paul Wheeler over the years, and of course stands his greyhounds at stud, Fernando Bale, Barsha Bale. There have been some others along the way as well. So Paul is going to have a chat about the great Paul Wheeler and what he has meant to breeding and racing in Australia and worldwide. And just on that sombre note, not the greatest way to start the show, we've had the passing of a few people in greyhound racing in the last 10 days. Ray Drew from down in Warrnambool and Andy Stewart, who won a Group 1 with a greyhound called Midwinter a number of years ago. So a sad time. They say things happen in threes. Let's hope that's it for a while in the greyhound ranks, because it certainly hasn't been the best couple of weeks for some of the participants. But a couple of weeks ago, the greyhound community, not only in Australia but worldwide, was shocked by the sudden death of Paul Wheeler, who is probably the most iconic and celebrated and successful breeders and owners of all time, and possibly the most successful ever see going forward. And I know over the last couple of weeks there's been some wonderful tributes to him, and our thoughts really do go out to the family, because he has left behind a dynasty, an empire, and someone who's very close to Paul and has been in recent years is Paul Westerveld. And I know we had Paul on a couple of weeks ago on the show, so I'd love to say back by popular demand, Paul, but unfortunately it's probably not as going to be as enjoyable for you today to talk about Paul Wheeler and what you remember of him and his passing. But we really do appreciate your time coming on Cracking the Codes this morning. Good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning, Simone. Good morning, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Paul. It's sad reflection, isn't it? But it's also important to remember somebody that it's contributed, so much. Paul Wheeler's legacy is a part of greyhound racing, and what he's put into it is, 100 others would probably not even be able to match what he's been able to contribute to the greyhound industry.
No, I couldn't agree more, Dan. Yeah, his legacy will live on and on and on, through his family, obviously Brendan and Nicole are going to continue running the operation from now, but just his breed, it's just, entrenched in our industry. Over the last, probably 7 or 8 years between Barsha and Fernando Bale, they've just dominated the stud scene. And there's obviously going to be lots of, stud dogs and his daughters to carry on, for many, many years to come.
Might just for those listeners who may not be overly familiar, they would have heard of the Bale dogs, Dinah and Alan. So they were the three suffixes, prefixes that Paul used with his greyhounds, and it would be hard to think that there's ever been a meeting over the last 20 years at least, Paul, that wouldn't have had one of those greyhounds in it somewhere in Australia.
No, it's just an iconic name, isn't it? But people
it is.
That, wouldn't have even known Paul Wheeler, but going into the pub and having a bet would yeah, certainly pick out a Bale dog or an Allen Diner dog and yeah, have their money on it just because of, yeah, how successful it was.
Well, in those the early days of the Bales, there were complete fields with a Bale in the name, whether it was a prefix or a suffix. So there'd be eight runners, and all of them would have Bale in it. There was a number of races that I can recall where that happened. Such was the dominance of that name and the breed.
Oh, it's incredible. And the amount of dogs, you know, like, he did breed a lot, but the percentage that got to the racetrack, his stats are phenomenal. It's just incredible. His rearing, the way it revolutionised greyhound breeding and rearing, it's incredible. I've been to his property and seen the way he does it, and, yeah, it's unbelievable, really, to see.
Paul, take us back to the early days of what you know or knew of Paul Wheeler and his operation, because everybody looks at that success, has looked at the Group 1s year after year that he's taken out. But the backstory is he was almost broke at one time, wasn't he? And it was one of those situations, do we go bigger and go hard, or do we just pack up and leave the sport and perhaps just retreat back into something a little bit more manageable? But he decided to go bigger and go hard, didn't he?
He did, yeah. No, he went really hard. He purchased a 3,000-acre property near Young in New South Wales and just set it up to a state-of-the-art facility. It's yeah, incredible to see. Like, he just turned his dog into competitive beasts, really. They work in six dog packs. They're reared. They go out into, you know, huge, like, they're in 100 metre by about 40-metre paddocks, and you know, depending on their age group, they get let out into even bigger acreage to, you know, run and compete with each other and bump and do all the things that they do in races. And, it certainly turns out to produce champions one after the other for the family.
You mentioned the size of the paddocks, Paul. How many dogs would he be breeding or rearing at any one time, or the highest stage he got to in his breeding career? How many dogs would he have on that property?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how many. I guess it varies. He wasn't breeding as much as what he used to when he first moved to the property, but just breeding quality. The females that he bred from, just very high standard. And I know he just loved using Fernando and Barsha, and a lot of the time he said to me, I just don't know where else to go. But obviously he had to. He said just because of their success at throwing group winners, they just stood out so much to him. And I know how proud he was. You know, he'd ring me every month, and we'd speak a lot more regularly than that. But, when they had a busy month with services and that sort of thing, and he got his statement, he'd ring up, and I just know, you know, how proud he was of his dogs, and how grateful he was to people in the industry that you know, set him up, by using his dogs so much.
Dan, in answer to your question, there were some reports, and I don't want to be quoted, but around 500 to 550 at the peak, he may have had that many dogs on the property, and so averaging out, what's that, maybe 10 litres a week over the year. Was it 500? Oh, that could be wrong, actually. I think it might have been 500 to 550 dogs, but maybe 3 litres a week, 150 litres some years. So roundabout figures. So an enormous operation. But Paul, can you just tell us how he changed the face of breeding at the time? He sort of went really left field, didn't he?
He did. He was always one to think left field, like you said. He started using outcrosses. I watched a thing where his dad used Glider's Son that didn't turn out to be a successful sire on a lot of their, nearly all their girls. And, yeah, it turned out a bit devastating for them financially. And then, he took over the breeding from then and, started to make his own calls on the dogs. And he ended up outcrossing dogs probably in the 2000s, early 2000s, I'd say, maybe late 90s. And he used American dogs, which weren't really the fashion at the time. A lot of people thought they were more of a dour type of dog and not the sort of sprinty type of dogs that we have on top of the ground. And he did, and he didn't get the greatest success with a lot of them that he used, but the girls that he bred on with, going back to Australian size, I guess with the hybrid vigour, was just, yeah, incredible. And just one after the other, he just, yeah, just met feats that I don't think anyone else will ever do, to be honest. He's, you see his trophy cabinet. It is a massive room with glass cabinets, and you're just getting the best trophies you can win in greyhound racing, and he's just got multiple trophies of those races, like Melbourne Cups, Golden Easter Eggs, you name it, Australian Cups. He's just won everything.
Yeah, certainly has. And those names, it's funny, there's a couple of dogs that stand out by name, and they would in any era. But just when you mention Alan, Dinah, and Bale, they've just about become the three most connected and recognisable names in greyhound racing. And what happens with this dynasty now? Where does it go to? Is it inherited by family? Will it be maintained in a similar vein? Do they streamline it down? Is there any thought from your end as to what happens from here, Paul?
Look, Brendan and his wife, Nicole, Brendan's obviously his son, he's just going to take over now, and he's really keen to do so. Jan and Paul were going to scale back and, I guess, you know, go and travel and do things that they deserve to do after their years of hard work. But certainly Brendan will, and Nicole will carry on the Wheeler Empire, and I don't see it slowing down at all. I think it's just going to keep going and continue to dominate in the years to come.
One of the races that we will probably never, ever see it again either, Paul, was the 2011 Melbourne Cup. And there was seven out of the eight runners were owned by Paul Wheeler. And so the odds of him winning that particular race were very, very high that year. And Gary Ennis trained Henry Walt. He was the only other greyhound that wasn't trained or owned by Paul Wheeler. So it was a fantastic event, and one of those nights where, you know, there was a few knockers out there that night, and a lot of whispers throughout the week and rumblings about, you know, we knew this would happen and that racing's been saturated by one particular person. But really, you just can't take anything away from Paul in that race, because, like you've mentioned, he started almost from scratch. He hasn't had success all the way through. He's worked very, very hard, and the percentage of greyhounds that he has got to the track over the years is a testament to how he's reared and produced them. And he deserves that. Isn't that showing that you are the best of the best?
Yeah, I agree. Everyone can, you know, have a crack in this industry. And the fact that he did what he did and invested everything, and really, I mean, it's just phenomenal to do what he's done and have seven dogs in a Melbourne Cup. I mean, that's just, yeah. I think there should be praised. There should be no negativity towards that, because it's, you know, such a hard race to win. No matter how many dogs you breed, it's to get seven of the eight finalists. It's an incredible feat.
And in 2015, we saw what was probably the equivalent of the Bone Crusher, our Waverley Star race, and that was between two of Paul's dogs, Fernando Bale and Dinah Double One. And the upset occurred. Thought Fernando Bale was going to win, but he dwelled at the start, which was quite unusual for him. And he mustered some pace, got around that first turn, but kennel mate Dinah Double One was just too good. Let's take a listen.
Racing. He was away only fairly, Fernando Bale. Lemia Bale won the start. Beervillaza threw on the inside with Dinah Tiber. Fernando Bale threw, cut across to the feet to the chip, took the lead into the back. Fernando Bale opened up two lengths on Dinah Double One to second from Black Illusion. Then Beervillaza three further back to Dinah Tiber, Zipping Meg. Lemia Bale and Secret Spell in front, Fernando Bale, but Dinah Double One with an eighth. They're three on for Beervillaza into the straight. Fernando Bale first for home. Dinah Double One closes. Dinah Double One maybe got Fernando Bale on the line in the cup. Black Illusion third, and fourth was Beervillaza. Fifth across, Zipping Meg from Dinah Tiber, then Secret Spell, and they were amongst the last over the line with Lemia Bale. Time for the cup is 29:16.
And that will probably be remembered as one of the greatest Melbourne Cup finals and victories and finishes in the history of greyhound racing, I'm sure, Paul. But on a personal note, you've had a lot to do with Paul Wheeler now, with holding or having his dogs at stud, and you've been just as successful and professional as what Paul was in taking that next step for the greyhounds with their life and producing them at stud. So on a personal level, can you just give us an insight into your operations with Paul?
Yeah, well, I'm just so grateful, to be honest. Our relationship was just one I'll never forget. I was just young, starting off in the stud dogs, and I rang him up because one of his champion dogs, Dinah Lachlan, I really like to use on one of my girls, and we had a great conversation, and in the end, he sent me Taranza Bale and Dinah Lachlan, which, like I said, I'd only just started, and I'd only had a couple of dogs of my own, particularly past the power, and Tony Lockett gave me a couple of dogs, and I was still really inexperienced, hadn't had a top sire at that point. And, yeah, he entrusted those dogs to me. And from then on, you know, whatever good dog he'd get, he'd say, Paul, did you want a standard at stud? And give me the opportunity and, you know, say yes or no. And, yeah, it's what it's done for our family by giving us those dogs, and in particular, like we said earlier, Barsha Vale and Fernando Vale, it's changed my family's life. And I'll be so forever grateful for him giving us his dogs. A bit emotional actually at the moment. Just not knowing you can't talk to the man, you know, ever again. I always love chatting to Paul. So, yeah, very grateful for everything he's done for us.
Oh, look, it's understandable, Paul, and I know this is difficult. It's still very, very raw for a lot of people, but one of the things you just mentioned about having the time, that's one thing that I always found with Paul, and he always gave you the time for an interview, would stop and say hello, even Jan, his wife, at award functions and things, always very, very pleasant. And I think he just resonated with people from all levels, didn't he? You didn't have to be in a particular circle for Paul to be someone that would engage with you.
Not at all. He didn't even know you. And if you gave him a call, you could be on the phone to him for an hour. He would give his time to people that, like I said, he didn't know. You know, not just myself as a stud master, but his trainers. You know, you speak to all of them, and how loyal he was to his trainers. You know, he just an incredible man. Generous with his time. Yeah, the amount of times he puts into the sport by doing seminars and that sort of thing, where he'd travel, you know, all around Australia, you know, out of his own pocket, just to help educate people, you know, going to the big races, you know, he'd turn up to awards nights, he'd go all over Australia for the industry, and people mustn't forget that, but he gave back, he didn't just take out of this industry.
So you can imagine leaving an awards night, it'd be like Santa Claus. He'd just have a bag full of trophies, wouldn't he? So,
yeah, you
get a few assistants. It leads me to the next question, whether or not there already is one or not, but would there be a significant race that should be created for to honour his name? There's so many new races that have come along. If indeed there is something that's already there, or maybe a plan or a thought that there could be a race that honours his name?
I haven't thought of that, Dan, but I think that'd be a fantastic thing for the governing bodies to talk about, make it a national race, to honour the man. I think that'd be a fantastic idea. I'm sure it'd be well sought after if they did do that.
I think there's absolutely no doubt that that will be on the cards, and it'll be something that they'll be trying to find the best race, and maybe even make up a new race to really honour someone that's had such an influence on breeding in this country for many, many decades and so well received. But Paul, look, I know it's been very difficult for you and for a lot of people, but just on a brighter note, when we had you on, it was about 8 weeks ago, we had you on Cracking the Codes. We were talking about your stud operation, but also at your... you were looking forward to an import, a greyhound called Explosive Boy. Has there been any updates on this particular greyhound and when he might be hitting Australian shores?
Yeah, not sure exactly when. After not winning the derby, he found lots of trouble, obviously, and finished fourth. The owner decided to keep going. I know the English derby was a race they were looking at, and another race which I just can't remember the name off the top of my head at the moment. So yeah, but he's at the moment being collected semen from him that's going to be exported to Australia. So there's 30 vials around about that we're aiming to get, and hopefully have them in the breeding season. He's had his vaccinations also, or what he needs at this point to be exported. It is a lengthy process. It can take about 6 months from start to finish. So at least, yeah, that's they've begun that. So when the time comes that he's going to be sent here, yeah, it's already the wheels are in motion, and yeah, he'll be ready to come out here to stand permanently.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing about Explosive Boy as things unfold, and also seeing him when he finally gets here to Australia. But some great news for breeders here, Paul, and really look forward to that. Thank you once again for your time this morning on a reflection on Paul Wheeler and his wonderful life and dynasty, and what he meant to you and the family, and the indelible mark that he's made on greyhound breeding here in Australia and worldwide. So we really do thank you for your time.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about him.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the codes.
Stylish Century, the one they've got to run down, though, on the turn, a length in front. Almirad stride by stride, and our Westminster coming with a great run at the 200-metre mark. Stylish Century in front. Almirad is starting to come after him on the outside. Almirad getting to Stylish Century, the pull and the weights. Almirad on the outside gets his nose in front. He's going home better, and Almirad, great performance, takes the Cox Plate. Almirad a nose to Stylish Century.
How tenacious was the imported galloper there, and Mick Clark had a good run on these imports. Of course, at Talak in a Melbourne Cup as well, and then the year after, Better Loosen Up. So this was the Mick Clark era, 89-90. And Simone and Dan, guess who we're going to have a chat to now? It's pretty easy. It's going to be Michael Clark, isn't it, given the build-up. Morning, Clarky.
Okay, Matty and Dan and Simone, morning.
How are you?
Morning, Michael.
Mate, just listening to that, it brings back a lot of good memories, and it's still exciting for me to hear those races and... he was a very underrated horse, Matty Almirad, because I think he only had about four starts, actually.
Yeah, he got beaten in the Craigley by a short half head. Your brother rode him, and then I think he was unbeaten with you, Mick. He won the Underwood, he won the Caulfield Stakes, and that Cox Plate where he beat Stylish Century, he gave Stylish Century 10.5 kilos under the weight for age scale, which is extraordinary in itself, and the depth of that race... it was my first Cox Plate overcalled, so to me, this is the greatest, you know. But there were two emergencies in the race just to show the depth. They were Cole Diesel, who had won two Group 1s at his previous two starts, and a horse called the Phantom, who just about chased home every champion around that era. So that's got to go down as one of the greatest Cox Plates. You had Zabeel, Empire Rose, Horlicks, King's High, Westminster, Vorogue, Courtzer, Tristan R. I mean, what a field.
Yeah, no, great horses, weren't they, that he actually beat? But I reckon he was probably one of the best horses I rode. You know, Better Loosen Up was certainly a great horse, probably, but, you know, there wouldn't have been much between the two of them. When Almirad won that day, you know, to wear Stylish Century down, there was no slouch, and Stylish Century, I think, come out and won the Derby the following week by about 5 or 6 lengths.
Clarky, Colin Hayes was the bit of pioneer we had, and then later on Jeune and obviously at Talak at around the time of Almirad. They didn't come out here with a great song and dance, did they? But they seemed to adapt to our conditions. Was there a trick to the ones that did click, like Almirad?
Oh, we had a fair few of them. I even remember what was called Stavardale, right? He was, you know, they talk about great trainers, him, Bart Cummings, Tommy Smith, God. But I think it was the environment he had his horses in. Like, they do a lot of work at Lindsay Park, and I think they adapted better to, you know, the Australian style of racing. And probably he trained them a bit lighter, you know, like not as endurance work. So I think that's where they adapted. But I remember Almirad, after that Cox Plate, was going to run in the Melbourne Cup. And he got scratched. He got injured at Breakfast with the Stars. And... I ended up riding a horse called Coots, right? And he ran third in the Melbourne Cup, and Almirad would have had, you know, 15, 20 lengths on him. That's how good he was.
Yeah, he was amazing. I think he'd had, because he was a seven-year-old when he won that Cox Plate, Mick, and I remember when he first came out here, he must have suffered some sort of an injury when he came from the UK, and he might have missed the autumn or something like that.
Yeah, I think John Godston, or one of those great trainers, brought him out here, right, for the Tancred Stakes, and he went amiss, and that's when CS got him, and he sort of took his time to get him over the injury, and that's his first preparation with the horse in Australia.
Michael, can you give us an insight into what it was like working and riding for Colin Hayes? I mean, people on the outside would see the setup on maybe the television of Lindsay Park's stud over the years and these beautiful white post and rail fences that went on forever and ever. But what was he like to ride for as a trainer? Was he a hard man to work for? Was he encouraging? What can you tell us from the inside?
I think he was firm but fair. You know, like, I found him a great man. Like, great family, actually. Like, David Hayes and Peter Hayes. Like, and that's why they've sort of, the systems kept going, because CS put it in place for him.
I actually had this kind of bleak situation with Colin Hayes, where he was, I went over to cover the Adelaide Carnival, Michael, well, it must have been the mid to late 90s when CS died, and I was to go to Lindsay Park, to drive to Lindsay Park during that time to interview Colin Hayes, and it was called off because he was so ill. And then Peter rang me at the last minute and said, "No, come up because he wants to see you." Not to see me specifically, but he's happy to see a reporter and have a chat type thing. And so I did a cruise of the stable in the four-wheel drive with Arthur Dabenig. And but at that stage he said, "Oh, sorry about this, but Colin's now too ill again and he won't be able to see you." And just as I was about to leave, Betty walked out onto the balcony of the homestead and said, "Oh, no, Colin's up for a chat." And I remember Tom Dabenig was there, who was probably 19 or something at the time, and Colin was sitting there in his pyjamas on a oxygen mask. He still had his rug in place, and he was gravely ill. He was a week from death, and he was talking about the new crop of rising two-year-olds and so on. So he was, even when he knew that he had run out of time, he was still... And that was the greatness of Colin Hayes, was he had this ambition and he was always looking ahead. Even though he was dying, he was still looking ahead to the next crop of two-year-olds. And that kind of gives an insight into the sort of guy he was and why he was so successful, always looking ahead.
Yeah, well, he used to have that same plan for the future. But David and him were so close, you know, like when I seen the father's son and relationship, it was amazing. And I think David's taken so much, you know, after his father.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt. It's almost a clone in a way. And he was emerging at that time. And you were part of that baton change, was you were front and centre, because it was between the Elmerad and Better Loosen Up Cox Plates, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. I think, yes, it was.
So Better Loosen Up, we all know the story of coming from Berrigan and Les Theodore and that amazing, amazing dusty story about where this champion came from. What was the difference one year to the next, Elmerad, Better Loosen Up, Michael? Was there, I think they had a similarly tenacious sort of relentless sort of gallop in them, didn't they? What was the, how would you compare Elmerad to Better Loosen Up?
Better Loosen Up was a lot more difficult to ride. He wasn't push button. Like, he'd get back in the field and he would hang in, actually. Like, he was not the easiest horse to ride, where Elmerad would put himself in a position, travel, and then had a really great turn of foot. But both great horses.
Let's have a listen while we're talking about Better Loosen Up. And it doesn't... You have to remember the race, but hopefully the call will capture it. You were at him from the 800, and it was the most relentless run. Have a listen to the final stages of Better Loosen Up.
Better Loosen Up and the Phantom. They've grabbed Stylish Century, 400 to go. Can he let out wide, raced up now to grab the front, Citizen, the challenger, and Better Loosen Up from a mile back. Can he let in front? But here's the Tasmanian champ now, Citizen on the outside. Citizen gets to, can he let in? Here comes Better Loosen Up with a mighty run. Citizen and Better Loosen Up. Better Loosen Up on the outside, going home. Better Loosen Up takes the Cox Plate. Wins it a half length to Citizen, a neck away.
Mick, you were, like all of them, a very, very fit athlete at this time. But when I, every every time I look at that race, I think, gee, you must have been tired after that. You really had to get him going a long way out, and it was a relentless ride and a relentless gallop, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he was that style of horse. Matty, like, that's what I'm saying. Almirad would travel and sprint, where you had to work better to get him going. And he was a dower, more dower, and, you know, that style of horse.
Michael, when you were so far at the, you're almost at the back of the pack, you may have even been last at one point, and you had a horse that, I think it was at the Phantom, that was out in front. He looked like he, you know, he'd sprinted straight to the front and he was just streets ahead of the rest of the field. What goes through your mind when you're back there? Do you think to yourself, well, I can't win from here at any chance? I've got the horse under me that I know can make up that ground. You know the leader's going to tire. How do you keep a sane mind when you're that far back, trying to make up that sort of ground and eventually do it?
Yeah, Simone, I remember looking up at one stage, and I reckon I was 25 lengths off the lead, but he wasn't that style of horse. If you rode him hard early and put him out of his comfort zone, he wouldn't finish the race off, and that was sort of the key style. But certainly worried about being so far off the lead. But he sort of, I reckon when I got to the 600, he was starting to really build momentum, and it was quite a, not soft win, but quite a really good win, because I think, you know, like on the line, he sort of had his ears pricked once he got to the front.
What about the time? I know the track changed with Strathair and so on, but it just jumps off the page. I've got the Wikipedia thing up here, and by the way, if anyone's religiously uses Wikipedia, they're now asking for money when you go to Wikipedia. So that's the end of Wikipedia for me. 201.5, Clarkey, and then the ones either side of it were 203.8 and 203.2. Winks couldn't beat that time. So that gives an indication of how full on that race was, and they just dropped off, and it was just the last man standing, wasn't it?
Yeah, but Manny, I think Bedalusion have actually improved after that race. Like, when he went to, you know, Japan and came back and won the Australian Cup, he just seemed to, you know, he had more of a squint about him, and he was more, you could ride him more up on the pace because he wanted to be there.
But he was, that time was amazing. He never won by big margins. That was the thing about him, Mick.
Except for that Australian Cup where he just cut loose.
Just that one race, And by that time, we'd all thought that, well, he'll win. He'll still win, but it'll only by a head or by a neck, and you'll get a bit nervous 100 from home, so it's worth taking the shorts. But he just, why, you know, when we use the terminology, they know where the post is. How do they know where the post is, Mick?
Oh, he certainly did. But what he'd do, when you loom up, beside him to go to the front, he would want to lay on him, and he'd actually ease up himself. He was just that sort of horse, and that's what made it difficult to ride him, because as you get to the front, he'd want to lay in and not, you know, ease himself up.
Hey, a lot of discussion, you know, and it's a very complex discussion about the way we breed horses and all that sort of thing. Back in those days, every single horse in the Cox Plate was one that when he walked past you, or he or she walked past you in the mounting yard, you go, wow, that's that famous horse, even down to the Citizens and the Rough Habits and all these horses later on. But these days, we seem unable to create that depth of weight for age horse, Mick. A lot of our races are fluffed out with international imports because we're not able to sustain those ranks ourselves. Do you have any thoughts at all on why there was so much depth of champions back then? A lot of them were geldings too, and I think the steroid rules might have played a bit of a role in the changing of that as well. Any idea why those fields were littered with champion geldings and others, and these days we struggle to get these sort of numbers?
I think the steroid rule definitely has changed things a little bit, Matty. But when you've seen Bedalusion up walk past, you wouldn't have looked at him twice. And I remember riding the Beale and horses like Cadstead, and they were just stunning looking horses. You know, they were, you know, just, they oozed class just looking at them. But you can never be fooled, because Bedalusion up, you wouldn't have said he was the best looking horse, but he had the best motor.
Michael, with your decades involved in the sport and a family that's been entrenched in racing, you must be pretty proud of your son,
Michael Jr.
Michael as well. Yeah, Michael Poy. Yeah, sorry. He is your son, but with your wife's surname that was going to, the surname of the family was going to die out if he didn't take it. So he is your son like the rest of them. But you must be pretty proud to have a son that's a jockey in the ranks. Is there a lot of advice you give him, or do you just leave him to his own devices and with the trainers he's working with? It must be difficult at times when you've seen so many generations of racing and the changes in it.
Oh, he's very proud of him. He's a workaholic. He's trying to improve all the time. He did something that me and my brothers never did, actually. He's been leading apprentice two times. And as they come out of their apprenticeship and they've got to compete against Damien Oliver and Craig Hume, it gets a bit harder.
It does. I remember talking to Greg Childs about Jordan, and he just said, look, it's evolved. He's a better rider than me. He's got more tools. They are more better trained. They're not as whip reliant. They're educated a bit more thoroughly than we were. How do you compare your, as a rider, your style maybe compared to your son? And obviously the evolution of the whip has changed as well. Is there much difference between Clark Junior and Clark Senior?
Well, I think the apprentice school's got a big bearing now. It's a lot better run than when I was. You've got Gouchy and Alf Matthews, Ronnie Hall. They've been there and done it, so they're giving the best advice. So I think that's sort of a big change as well.
And with the, that tough time, Mick, when a successful apprentice or even an apprentice that, hasn't had the success, but when they're losing their claim or they're outriding their claim or they hit their time, it's a pretty difficult period. So how's Michael going at the moment?
Well, that's what I think he's finding a little bit tougher on, in the sense that he's got to compete against Craig and Oliver on level terms. But I think if he keeps working at it, you just got to improve that little bit more to get to their level.
Hey, Mick, what's got the bigger roar? So go back to Almarad, go back to Better Loosen Up, then go to Atalak with the Melbourne Cup, but then the crazy Japan Cup with Better Loosen Up. Which was the most thunderous sort of winning race for you of those four?
I think the Melbourne Cup managed the special one for sure, but the Japan Cup was amazing. To win a Cox Plate is unreal. Like, the atmosphere of the Cox Plate and the Japan Cup and the Melbourne Cup, any jockey will tell you, you go to that next level. It was amazing in the Japan Cup. Because you felt like you were doing it more for Australia. That was the difference there.
Was that just on that, because Dan and Simone, you might remember this, but Simone's a tad younger than us, Clarkie, so she might not remember this, but
it's a photo finish, though.
The Japan Cup. Do you remember this, Mick? The Japan Cup always coincided with a last session of the cricket, whether it was one of the Sydney Test or the Adelaide, whatever Test match it was, and then they would cross at 5:15 for 15 minutes, and we would watch the Japan Cup. And that was the situation with Better Loosen Up, where you had Tony Gregg and Richie Beno going, all right, well, this is all very interesting with, Dennis Lilly and whatnot, but now let's cross to Japan. And the whole sporting sphere got involved because it was contained in the cricketing coverage as well. So did you get that sense that it was bigger than racing, that you were, because it was a pioneering thing you did. We never, other than Farlap and a few others, we just didn't take them overseas. And it was seen here as a validation of the quality of our horses that you're able to do it. Did you feel all of that when you're over there, when you crossed the line?
Oh, I knew it was a lot bigger. You felt like you had Australia behind you. I'm not a cricket buff, and I didn't realise that. But when you talk about Richie Beno and Greg, pretty big names, and it had a bigger effect on racing here than I imagined. From being in Japan. And I think after it, Matty, I realised how big it is. Like, people still talk about it today. And we haven't had another Australian horse do it, but hopefully we can.
I mean, probably spurred a few others to have a crack at it, because we did have some great horses go over there in the that aftermath, that sort of 10-year period. Horlicks led the way, and then, you know, probably put that race on the map, and then Better Loosen Up, and particularly from where he came from, because here's a gelding up against some of the best bred horses in the world, knocking them off on their own patch. Yeah, I could understand how you felt like a proud Aussie that day, Mick, because it was something very special and treasured, a treasured memory for the whole racing industry from that year. And, well, we were looking at 31 years ago.
Yeah, and Brian Martin was there and called the racer back home, and he had a special affinity with Gabe Farrer and David Hayes and Colin Hayes and me. So that made it really special. But, yes, yeah, it was a wonderful thing to look back on.
Michael, a few months ago we had Clint Hutchison on Cracking the Codes, and he spoke about his time in Hong Kong and how the jockeys over there are really treated like rock stars. Did you get that rock star treatment all those years back in Japan?
No, I wasn't, Simone, I wasn't quite good-looking enough to get the rock star look. But the racing there is amazing in a sense. Everyone follows racing, and you'll go to the races and they'll have the chanting for their local horses. They'll have flags and with the horses' names. And racing's a very big thing there, and jockeys are a little bit like an icon. And there's a jockey there called Yutaki. And I remember there's a big billboard in Tokyo of him wearing designer clothes. And the jockeys are very more high profile, and which is probably, you know, in Australia, a jockey's a jockey. And, you know, it's a little bit different the way they're treated in Japan and Hong Kong.
Was there a horse called Katsuragi Ace in your Japan Cup, or was that a different one? I've got this memory of a horse called Katsuragi Ace.
No, I think it was a different one, Matty, but there was a... I beat a French horse and...
Ode?
And there was a very good English horse in the race that... I think Steve Corfin rode, actually. So we're going back a long time. But it was definitely a really strong field.
Now, Steve Corfin, he was a rock star. He was a rock star. Clarky, even at the height of your game, where you were the very handsome champion jockey, don't put yourself down, you're a very handsome superstar jockey, you were always very low-key, though, and so was Gary, and it was there were the glamour jockeys of the time. And as you slipped into retirement, I know you live Bayside, and I gratefully run into you every now and then. We haven't through COVID, and looking forward to a beer at the Bentley RSL with a few others, but... How's life for you now? I mean, it is difficult anonymity, isn't it, for former champion sports people? But you seem very, very comfortable in your life these days.
Yeah, I was lucky, Matty. Gabe Farrer, who actually was a major shareholder in Better Loosen Up, sort of took me under his wing and advised me financially. And back then, as I was making money, I bought property. And luckily, I've got them today, and nothing major, but they're businesses that I can run, and then I can, gives me more time to spend with my children, follow Michael. And when Michael's mum was alive, actually, she had a major influence on following Michael. We would spend every day, you know, watching him or taking him to the races, taking him to trials, taking him to track work, things like that. And I remember she actually started out... when Michael first started, they weren't allowed to have managers, and Janelle would get on his phone and send texts to trainers to see if he could ride track work, ride trials. And I remember we took him to Hamilton one day, and Caston and places like that, to ride trials for Darren Weir. So she had a big influence on Michael and his career, and she said, the harder you work, the luckier you get. So one good thing is adopted her attitude.
Yeah, and what a wonderful attitude that is. You haven't got a cheap rental, have you, of all your property empire? The times have changed for me. You haven't got a cheap one for a mate, have you, around Bayside?
Sorry, mate?
You haven't got a cheap rental with your property portfolio? I'm sort of might be transitioning.
Only if you want to live in a shop, Matty.
Can do. Can do.
No, but that's...
Not
that's
a bottle shop, one. Though.
That's where I was lucky, is I had really good advice, and he's still got a lot of horses. Peter Devitt and unfortunately Les Gordon passed away, but they were amazing to me, and not just to me, to people like David Hayes, Brian Martin, especially Gary Barrow, his advice back then by Byron Property, is bricks and mortar, he used to say to me, and just fortunate that I had his advice.
Just as we say goodbye, and it's been a special treat to have you on today, Mick. It really has been. I must admit, I wonder where you were at, and it had been a long time since I think I'd heard you on the radio, so it's great to reminisce. But I've got a list of horses here that you've ridden. Better Loosen Up, 12 wins. Special, 8 wins. Quabot, 7. Eastern Classic, 7. Military Plume, 6 wins. Midnight Fever, 6. Zabeel, 5. Scarlet Bisque, 5. Even Hariba, 5 times. And then add to the Elmerads and the Italics. And that's an amazing group of some of the most famous horses in racing history.
Yeah, I think that all comes back to, like, the Hayes family for me. I started out as an apprentice, right? And then I moved to number 3 jockey behind Mickey Mahon and Brent Thompson. And I slowly climbed the ladder there. And I think when you're working for people like that, and back then the trainers were a lot more loyal. Like Colin Hayes was a very loyal man. He'd give you a pay. And you know, they'd analyse the race if you made a mistake, which was fine. But you still knew you were going to be riding the horses the following week, and he had that list of great horses. When you mentioned Quabot and Ariba, that obviously he didn't have them, but a great friend and family friend, Robbie Lang and Eddie Lang. Eddie Lang gave me a go on Quabot when I was probably 18. I rode him in the what they have now, the Manitano Stakes, right, and he beat a really Gouchy rode a horse with Tommy Smith, actually, that I beat. But he was a trainer that gave a young kid a go, and he stuck with me. And that sort of got me going, and that's where I, from there, went to Colin Hayes. And, you know, I sort of look back and think how lucky I was to have those sort of people helping me.
You didn't have Simon Marshall in your corner. We had him on about 6 months ago. He completely white-handed you on Hariba. He got in the ear of the trainer, and he just completely stitched you up there. But anyway, that's just the rub of the green, Clarkie.
No, but I will tell you, Matty, right? I think I won about 5 races on Hariba. And I'm riding him in that 1400, used to be like the show day cup of Caulfield. And back then, Kenny Newman said to me, he said, like, Hariba was a horse that you'd let run. He was a big horse, right? And he actually said to me to, you know, try and hold him up to run the 1400. And when I did, he resented being behind horses, and it just wasn't the right move. And then that's when I got the sack. So I was actually trying to do what he told me, but, you know, it wasn't the right move that day on the horse.
Oh, well, you had a lot of other amazing, as Dan said, that list is quite extraordinary. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on Cracking the Code this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm glad to hear you're doing well, and look forward to catching up with you. And I'm sure we're trying to organise a bit of a beer garden gathering that it seems to be growing and growing and growing. So hopefully you'll be able to make it along after release, and we can continue this conversation.
No, it'd be great, mate. And thanks, Simone, and thanks, Dan, and I love listening to your show, and thank you so much for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. Look after yourself, mate.
Thank you.
Oh, Mick Clark there. What a lovely guy. I remember when I was starting out, he was a megastar. Dan, you and I, you're a bit older, but we're roughly the same age. And I remember when I was coming through the ranks, Mick Clark was a god. He still is. I mean, he's just such a wonderful guy. And but he was always
so helpful, man,
and humble.
I remember going to track work, you know, 4 times a week at Flemington, and he was so helpful. I can't tell you how good he was at his job, and such a wonderful elite horseman, but so helpful for me coming through the ranks as well. As with the Hayes team, you know, I remember it so fondly, and I'm, you know, I reflect back on how successful he was, and like you say, he was the biggest jockey in Melbourne. There was a period there with the greatest horses and the greatest racing stable in Australia at the time, and it was fantastic to reminisce with him and talk to him this morning.
And Simone, he does listen to our show. When I rang him up to organise him as a guest, and thanks to Dan for suggesting Mick Clark as well, he said, "I love that show, and I swear to God, Simone," he said, "and I really like that."
And this is an atheist.
Yes, this is staunch. I really like that Simone, he said. I think she's wonderful. Oh.
Well, I definitely think we need to have
I argued with him about that for a while.
Okay. Well, I think we need to have him on the list for our beer garden. But I was just thinking, looking back to the 1986 at Toolak win in the Melbourne Cup, and took me back to the Year 7 classrooms along a Fraser Street at Sacred Heart there. And I remember the cup would be broadcast through the PA system in the classrooms, which these days doesn't happen anymore because the kids all have a day off and have an extra long weekend. But used to either sit in the quadrangle at Sacred Heart listening to it on the PA system or in the classroom. And it would have been, I remember vividly, the Year 7 classroom. We used to hang out of the windows and wave and yell out to the Geelong College boys. But you would have been almost finished. You probably would have been finished by then.
No, I was still at the junior. So I was still at the junior school.
He repeated grade like, 6-4 times.
And don't you love the good Catholic girls of the 80s and 90s, Dan? They loved a bet. They were hanging out the windows to listen to the last leg of the quaddie. Speaking of that, last leg of the quaddie today will be, what, about 5-ish? And by then, 5:30, we'll know who won the Cox Plate. What an exciting day. It's Simone, even for someone who's a bit on the fringe of it, there's something about the Cox Plate, isn't there?
And I've got that one memory that I've spoken about. This is the third time on Cracking the Codes of Might and Power. I remember that day vividly as well, being down in the members area. Someone gave us tickets, a friend and I, and looking at Might and Power in the stalls and Nick Moraitis. And I just remember that day vividly. So that's my standout memory of the Cox Plate. But when you look back and listen to these replays like we have this morning, the names of those horses were just names that you heard all the time and you didn't have to really be involved in racing too much.
Exactly, Dan. Looking forward to catching up with you in a few hours' time to set the scene. And then I'm really looking forward to that moment when they canter to the gates and then you just think, what's going to happen here? So that's all going to play out today. And next week we can reflect on that and look forward to Derby Day.
Absolutely. We're right in the thick of things now, aren't we? And the most important race days of the year are with us and we're loving it.
Good on you guys. See you next week.